From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the whistleblower who exposed Cambridge Analytica's role in the Trump presidential campaign. Cambridge Analytica collected personal data from tens of millions of Facebook users and used it to target people susceptible to conspiracy theories and disinformation. Christopher Wiley was the research director at Cambridge Analytica before leaving in protest over the direction it had taken. When he joined the company, its goal was countering extremists using social media to find potential converts.
The things that I was building, you know, originally for the defense of our democracies had been completely inverted to really, in my view, attack our democracies.
Wiley has written a new book, and Ken Tucker reviews the first solo album from Brittany Howard, the lead singer of Alabama Shakes. My guest became a whistleblower, exposing the role of the British voter profiling company Cambridge Analytica in the Trump presidential campaign and the Brexit campaign. Christopher Wiley revealed how the company had harvested the information of tens of millions of Facebook users and combined that with other data to create psychological profiles and then use those profiles to target people susceptible to disinformation, racist thinking, and conspiracy theories. Cambridge Analytica then helped shape the disinformation narratives and push them out. Wiley also revealed Cambridge Analytica's links to Russia. Wiley had the documents and tapes to back him up. He'd served as Cambridge Analytica's research director for a year and a half, then quit in 2014, disturbed by the direction it started taking after Steve Bannon became a major player in the company. Wiley became the chief source for a year-long investigation into Cambridge Analytica, jointly undertaken by the British paper The Guardian and The New York Times. Both papers published their stories on March 17th last year. 10 days later, Wiley was called before Parliament to testify. After that, several U.S. congressional and Senate committees asked to talk with him. Within weeks, the EU and more than 20 countries had opened inquiries into Facebook, social media, and disinformation. Wiley has written a new book whose title I can't say on the radio, so I'll just call it Mind F, Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. Christopher Wiley, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a brief overview of how Cambridge Analytica figured into the Trump campaign. And we'll get into more detail about this later, but just so we have a basis of understanding of what it did.
The basis of Cambridge Analytica's work was essentially to take large amounts of highly granular data about each individual voter in the United States. A large bulk of that came from Facebook, but it came from many sources. And to look for patterns in that data to essentially infer different psychological attributes, and from that to find target groups of people, particularly on the fringes of society, who would be more vulnerable to certain kinds of messaging. They focused on a lot on disinformation. They targeted people who were more prone to conspiratorial thinking. And they used that data, and they used social media more broadly to first identify those people and then engage those people and really begin to craft what, in my view, was an insurgency in the United States.
Feeding them disinformation, sometimes conspiracy theories, in support of the Trump campaign.
Yes, and more broadly, the when Steve Bannon took over, he wasn't just concerned about particular elections. He followed sort of this notion of the Breitbart doctrine, which is that politics exists downstream from culture. So don't just focus on the day-to-day politics. Try to actually make an impact on an enduring change in culture, because politics will just flow from that.
When you say when Steve Bannon took over, he had a big role in Cambridge Analytica and then became campaign manager for Trump.
Yes, he did. He found us in London. He convinced a billionaire to acquire the company, and then he transformed that company into a set of tools that he would be able to use to, in effect, manipulate a certain segment of the American voter population.
So I want to talk about your contribution to this before you became a whistleblower. So you went to work for a company called SCL, Strategic Communication Laboratories. What were they when you joined, and what's their relationship to Cambridge Analytica?
Yeah, so I got recruited to join a research team at SCL Group, which at the time was a British military contractor based in London. Most of its clients were various ministries of defense in NATO countries. And what we were looking at is how to use data online to identify people who would be likely targets of different extremist groups. And from that, try to understand and unpack how would a fairly extreme ideological message spread through different kinds of social networks, and what could we do in order to mitigate its effectiveness. When Steve Bannon got introduced to the company, he realized that a lot of that work could be inverted. And rather than trying to mitigate an extremist insurgency in certain parts of the world, he wanted to essentially catalyze one in the United States.
One of your major contributions to Cambridge Analytica, which started off as SCL.
Yeah.
So one of your major contributions was to find this technique of personality profiling that you thought could be applied to the kind of work Cambridge Analytica was doing. Can you describe that personality profiling approach?
Yeah, so, you know, when you think about all of the things that you put online, so whether it's, you know, your what TV shows you like, or, you know, what movies you watch, or what you listen to, these are all little discrete clues about sort of who you are as a person. And, you know, originally when we were looking at this for defense purposes, we wanted to figure out beyond what the military had already identified, which was essentially young unmarried males with certain demographic characteristics, what were the sort of psychological characteristics of those people that would make them more prone and more vulnerable to certain kinds of messaging so that we could engage them beforehand. That was based on a series of studies, many of which came out of the University of Cambridge, that looked at essentially how, particularly with Facebook data, you can quite accurately predict a person's personality profile. And from that, if you can understand how a person sort of thinks and feels and engages in the world and what kinds of biases they have, you can then figure out what's going to be most effective at engaging them in a particular objective. So originally in some kind of counter-extremism or mitigation strategy, later when it became Cambridge Analytica, it essentially became identifying people who, in the same way that you'd be looking for people who'd be more vulnerable to ISIS messaging, people who were more prone to conspiratorial thinking or, you know, paranoid ideation. Effectively, it looked for the same kinds of people, but rather than discouraging them from, you know, joining ISIS, it would be to encourage them to join the alt-right.
You had to figure out a way to harvest data that you could use to create personality profiles so that you'd know who to target. And a lot of the data came from Facebook. How did Cambridge Analytica get the data?
You know, when the story blew up, one of the things that people kind of often talked about is how it was a hack of Facebook, or there was some kind of data breach. And what actually happened was that Facebook authorized the applications that Cambridge Analytica ended up using to access the data. The company engaged professors at the University of Cambridge to create an application that then got put onto Facebook, where people would go and fill out personality inventories, like surveys about, you know, who they are and their attributes. But the way the app worked was that they wouldn't just harvest the data of the person who responded to that survey, but it would go into their profile and look at all of their friends and harvest all of their friends' data as well. So when you had one person fill out a survey, by default, they effectively consented by proxy for, you know, hundreds of other people simply because they were Facebook friends with them. So that scaled really quickly. And at the time, Facebook, the way Facebook worked, they allowed applications to have that feature. They've since turned it off, and rightfully so. But at the time, you could acquire a lot of data really quickly, because with each respondent to that survey, you'd get another sort of 300 profiles with it.
In return for filling out the personality profile, you were given like a couple of dollars or something?
Yeah. So different kinds of people have different motivations for filling out surveys. So, you know, sometimes you would have a group of people who just would fill it out because they're bored and they don't have anything to do, or they would just genuinely want to know what is their, you know, personality. Or, you know, if you had apps that were sort of like, you know, what, you know, if you were on Game of Thrones, who would be your character? Fill out this survey and find out. You know, little do they know that actually it's taking all of that information and porting it over to an alt-right campaign. But, you know, in some cases, with certain groups of people that were underrepresented in those samples, they would be paid, you know, $1, $2 around there to fill out a survey. And people do a lot for a dollar, which was actually quite surprising.
So Cambridge Analytica undergoes this big transformation. Steve Bannon comes in from America. He wants to harness this information for his own purposes. He brings in Robert Mercer, who's a hedge fund billionaire, who basically buys the company. And Mercer was like a major right-wing donor, a major donor eventually to the Trump campaign. So Cambridge Analytica becomes harnessed by Mercer and Bannon to serve the purposes of the far right or the alt-right. You're still working with Cambridge Analytica at that time. And as the research director, you had to understand the personalities and inclinations of Americans. Cambridge Analytica sent a lot of people to America to do psychological research, psychological profiling. Just give us an overview of what that was like.
You know, I'm Canadian, and most of the people on the team were not Americans. So when we go into the United States, we don't grow up with the same narratives or the same biases, cultural biases that a lot of Americans do. So we look at the United States in the same way that we'd be studying Africa, for example. So we had a lot of anthropologists who would come and sociologists who would come to actually do qualitative research, anthropological research, looking at the dynamics of different kinds of people. And, you know, it's amazing, you know, you really start to unpack really bizarre things. You have the rise of extremist groups in the United States. It's just you don't call them that, right? You've got, some very cultish followings and belief systems. And we identified that fairly early on. And it was amazing. Like, I would go and I would sit with people. There was one example where I sat in the living room with people as they were watching Fox News, and just how bizarrely, almost therapeutic it was for them to come home and they could release all of their stresses by yelling at the TV and blaming Obama for everything. The fact that they didn't have health care, they were underemployed was all a plot from Obama to change the face and the fabric of America, and that they were the victims here and it was Obama's fault. And you sort of sit and you start to really realize that underneath this, you know, very advanced modern democracy, there are some like really screwed up things happening in society. So we would do reports and send them back. Later, when the data profiling actually started, those were the first sets of targets that the company started to engage. So first identifying those people and then inviting them into groups or pages. And very quickly, you know, imagine you're sitting there in your living room at midnight and you just see some ads and you click on it. And then all of a sudden, you know, you join a group and you start reading about stuff. And then all of a sudden, you know, other people start friending you or sending you messages like, hey, like, welcome to the group, you know, whatever, Smith County Patriots. I'm just a regular American from a couple counties over. Like, have you seen this? Isn't this crazy? And people would start to engage and build relationships with other people on these groups, thinking that it feels very random. Like, I chose to click on this. I chose this. But actually not realizing that they were there because they were chosen.
So when Cambridge Analytica starts actually organizing events, targeting people who had already kind of bought in on Facebook to the paranoia that Cambridge Analytica was spreading, you say that the events would be held in small places like a small bar or a coffee shop to make it look like, oh, it's really crowded, like this is really a popular thing.
If you only had, say, 5 to 10% of people on these groups actually agreeing to show up to an in-person event, if those groups are relatively small, you know, by Facebook standards or by social media standards, a couple thousand people, you're still getting, you know, 50 to 100 people agreeing to show up to an event. And so, you know, you would have these sort of staged events where they would be, you know, in a coffee shop or in a bar, as you said. And it does something very fundamental to a person, because what starts off as sort of this, you know, dabbling in a digital fantasy, you know, in the comfort of their living room, it moves into their reality, because they're now standing in a crowded room that's filled with people who are all talking about the exact same thing that they're thinking about and they're feeling. And, you know, when they go and meet people, you know, they're a plumber, they're an electrician, they're a teacher, they don't seem to have, you know, a big political agenda or something behind them. And so when you hear, as that person, you know, somebody talking about, you know, what Obama is doing by moving, you know, soldiers into Texas because he's planning something, or, you know, all these people crossing the border, that, you know, or the deep state or all of this, you're listening to people who just look and sound exactly like you, and they couldn't possibly have an agenda. But then when you turn on, you know, NPR, CNN or NBC or whatever, or read the New York Times, you don't see any of these things that are, you know, in your view, actually happening in your country. And you start to detach yourself from this institution of journalism because you stop believing it. You think that this is actually propaganda that I'm reading.
So one of the things that Cambridge Analytica found in doing research on Americans and personality profiles of Americans, so there are a lot of Americans who have racist feelings that they don't publicly express for fear that they'll be shunned as a result. But if you give them an opportunity to express it without any criticism, then it will start to surface. If you could talk a little bit about finding that out and how that was harnessed by Cambridge Analytica and the Trump campaign.
Yeah. Steve Bannon, you know, discovered that there's nothing more powerful than a humiliated man, and that, you know, when you looked at a lot of the narratives that emerged originally from the anthropological research that was happening and then later got verified in more quantitative research, that there were groups of typically heterosexual white men who sort of felt that because they could no longer be, quote unquote, a real man, they couldn't show who they, quote unquote, felt like they really were. They almost felt closeted. And it was really interesting to look at people in, you know, who are very privileged in many respects, racially and you know, with their sexual orientation and everything. You know, to be a straight white man in America is to have, you know, the world in front of you. But at the same time, there was a group of people who felt like they couldn't be who they were. And the pent up sort of...
They couldn't be who they were because it
is no longer acceptable, and in my view, rightfully so, to, you know, walk up to the secretary and, you know, squeeze her bum. It's no longer, you can't catcall. You can't do things that for these men, when they were growing up, was normalized, and over time, you know, society moved on from that, and they felt that, you know, this is who I am, and America's changing, and that means that I can't be who I am. And when you have, you know, people who feel like they're being oppressed, even if it's a misperception of oppression, that's a really powerful force. And Steve Bannon tapped into that.
How did he tap into it?
Because if you give people an easy excuse, you know, not to say that actually the behavior that you want to, you know, exhibit at work or at a bar is unacceptable, but rather that it's because, you know, Obama doesn't want you to have power anymore because we're giving the power over to women or to immigrants or whomever, that all of a sudden you now have a very easy justification. I'm not a bad person struggling with, like, bad habits. I'm actually being oppressed. And I now have an easy explanation as to, you know, why it is that I feel this way. And actually, I'm angry about it because it's not me that's the problem. It's them that's the problem. And, you know, if you have a group of people who feel like their privilege is being taken away, their entitlements are being taken away, and they feel like they're being oppressed and in effect closeted, you know, they will come out. When you look at a Tea Party rally, you know, one of the things that I even told him is, I said, when you look at a Tea Party rally, to me, it sounds a lot like gay pride. Because, you know, they would have these flags that say, don't tread on me, don't get in my way, let me be who I want to be, and just get out of my way. You look at a gay pride rally, there's more glitter, but it's the same message. And so, you know, part of this for him was to, like, uncloset these people. The, you know, these racists and misogynists needed to come out.
My guest is Christopher Wiley. His new book is called Mind F: Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. After a break, we'll talk more about the company's role in the Trump campaign, and Wiley will tell us why he became a whistleblower. And then Ken Tucker will review the first solo album by Brittany Howard, the lead singer of Alabama Shakes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Third Love, working to create bras and underwear that are comfortable for all women. Co-founder and CEO Heidi Zack explains why it was important to have real women as their models.
Women come in all shapes and sizes, and we really wanted to illustrate that through the imagery that we use and through the way we even talk about women's bodies. Third Love is meant to be a brand that all women can see themselves being a part of.
To find your perfect fit and get 15% off your first order, go to thirdlove.com/fresh.
Let's get back to my interview with Christopher Wiley, the whistleblower who revealed the role that the voter profiling company Cambridge Analytica played in the Brexit and Trump campaigns. He revealed how the company had harvested the information of tens of millions of Facebook users and combined that with other data to create psychological profiles and then use those profiles to target people susceptible to disinformation, racist thinking, and conspiracy theories. Cambridge Analytica then helped shape the disinformation narratives and push them out. Wiley served as Cambridge Analytica's research director for a year and a half, then quit in 2014, disturbed by the direction it started taking after Steve Bannon became a major player in the company. Wiley's new book is called Mind F: Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. When we left off, we were talking about how Cambridge Analytica wanted to target people who had racist or sexist views, but were afraid to reveal those views in public. How did Cambridge Analytica know who to target, people who would have those kind of, you know, like racist or sexist opinions, but feel too inhibited to express them, but felt empowered when they heard people in the Trump campaign or Trump himself expressing them? How do they know who to target?
So there's no such thing as sort of a silver bullet, like if you like this one thing on Facebook, that means that you're going to be an alt-right target. But there are certain sort of common features. You know, for example, certain kinds of movie viewing, right? So if you look at movies with Adam Sandler in it, not to, you know, bash Adam Sandler to associate him in any way with the alt-right. There were certain kinds of films, for example, where if you actually looked at the narratives within those films, you know, it's guy gets girl, it's very, you know, a very standard sort of formulaic relationship or some kind of formulaic problem. Men are exhibited in a certain way, women are exhibited in a certain way. You know, that would be, for example, a clue. How people engage with, for example, parenting, right? So, like, you know, one of the strongest predictors for alt-right nationalism was, like, your views on corporal punishment with children. If you think that children should be physically disciplined, you're much more likely to engage or dabble with more extreme right-wing views than other people would. There's no single thing that you would look for, and oftentimes this is what an algorithm would do, because a single person couldn't possibly look at millions of different features, all the different possible combinations of things that you could, you know, like or click on or what have you. So oftentimes it was, you know, a constellation of things that would create a target profile, but there were some common features to it.
So you write in the book that one of the things Cambridge Analytica did, one of its goals, was to try during the 2016 presidential campaign to move people on the left to vote for a third party candidate, Jill Stein. So how did Cambridge Analytica try to promote third party candidates like Jill Stein?
One of the things that the company started to unpack was just, you know, how much hurt and pain there are in all kinds of different groups in the United States. There's a lot of resentment across the board in different groups. And so, you know, when you, for example, target African Americans with, you know, narratives about how in the 90s, you know, Democrats had this idea or supported, or some Democrats supported, like, this notion of super predators and put lots of African Americans in prison, or that they're just, you know, taking you for a ride, they just want your vote, they're not actually going to help you. You know, and or on the flip side, you know, identifying people on the progressive side of the spectrum who also were more prone to conspiratorial thinking, you know, things about chemtrails or vaccines or things like that, and promoting essentially a mirror image of conspiracy theories at certain kinds of progressive people who otherwise would support Democrats to support a third party candidate or to not vote because of it.
You started hearing things in the Trump campaign that you knew Cambridge Analytica had tested, including in reports sent to Steve Bannon before Trump announced his candidacy, phrases like build the wall, drain the swamp. What was the first you heard of those phrases, and how were they tested?
Yeah. You know, I left the company because I didn't agree with what it was doing. And so after Donald Trump, you know, announced his candidacy and started rising in the polls, I started hearing just like in news reports, just these phrases that I distinctly remember in reports that were sent within the company about phrasing or sort of constructs that were really effective at winning over certain groups of people. When people talked about immigration, for example, so often people would just say, like, if I had people coming into my house, I would just build a big fence or I'd build a wall around it. Why aren't we just doing that? And that got reported back to Steve Bannon. I think that Steve, you know, when he started advising the Trump campaign and speaking to the Trump campaign even before Donald Trump had announced that he was running, I suspect that this was something that got communicated, because it's for me, eerily similar, those campaign narratives, to some of the reports that we had internally within the company.
Cambridge Analytica not only helped shape the narrative for the Trump campaign and helped the Trump campaign find people who would be susceptible to false information, to fake news that the Trump campaign was putting out. You're right that Cambridge Analytica had connections to Russia. Can you give us a sense of what those connections were?
Well, some of the consultants that were hired on the campaign, and even before that, their business partners were former GRU officers, that's the Russian security services. Some of them were indicted later by Mueller. You know, when we had some of the psychologists on, you know, working on these projects, going to St. Petersburg in Russia to give presentations to Russian colleagues on the effectiveness of psychological profiling, specifically in American political campaigns, where those same psychologists were also working on state-funded projects in Russia to look at psychological profiling of social media users with respect to, you know, bullying behavior, trolling, that sort of thing. And then also, when all of this work was being done, we got approached by large Russian companies, including oil companies, that had no sort of clear purpose as to why they would want large American voter data sets, but were asking about, you know, what is it that the company has? What is the capability of the company? And, you know, there's email correspondence where, you know, briefings that were put together on internal capacity and, you know, how many American records were profiled that got sent to the CEO of, you know, a large Russian company who is personal friends with Vladimir Putin. You know, when you look at some of the clients that it had, for example, in Britain during the Brexit campaign, you know, some of the largest funders of pro-leave, pro-Brexit campaigns were simultaneously meeting regularly with the Russian ambassador in London to talk about all kinds of things, including references to what was happening both on the Brexit campaign, but also, you know, they were traveling to the United States and meeting with the Trump campaign.
When you were at Cambridge Analytica, you met with executives from Lukoil, which is, I think, the largest oil company in Russia, and you later learned that Lukoil is sometimes used as a front for the FSB, the Russian intelligence agency. So you were afraid that everything you were telling the Lukoil executives, you might as well have been telling to Russian intelligence.
Yeah, well, you know, I found out that Lukoil has a formal information sharing agreement with the FSB, which is Russian intelligence, is one of the Russian intelligence agencies. And the same company had been involved in different kinds of influence operations throughout Europe with different European countries, you know, politics. And so one of my concerns was, first of all, why does this Russian oil company need information on, you know, American voter data sets, you know, or what the company is doing in American politics? But then also that, you know, this company has a very deep relationship with Russian intelligence organizations, and that by communicating our capacity and also at the same time letting them know that some of the psychologists that are working on this project are also partly in St. Petersburg in Russia, where they're giving very open presentations to Russians about the effectiveness of voter targeting using social media data, that it wouldn't be outrageous to suggest that there might have been a move to access that information, whether Cambridge Analytica knew it or not. There was a lot of relationships and a lot of communications with different fairly senior Russian officials that I found personally very concerning and odd, that there was just one country that was seemed to be very interested in what the company was doing.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Wiley, and he's the author of the new book, Mind F, I can't really say the word on the air, Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. He was the research director there for a year and a half and then became a whistleblower exposing Cambridge Analytica's role in the 2016 presidential election in the U.S. and in the Brexit election. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from E-Trade. Technology is making investing easier every day. Consider core portfolios from E-Trade. It's a simplified approach to investing that saves you time by building, monitoring, and managing a portfolio for you, with access to support whenever you need it. With core portfolios, investing never feels like work. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Capital Management, LLC.
Hey, Asma, I think it's time for a big change.
All right, what does that mean?
I think it's time to make the NPR Politics Podcast a daily podcast.
Well, we do have more than ample news. You and I are on the campaign trail, it seems like, nonstop.
And now there's an impeachment inquiry into President Trump.
So starting this week, the NPR Politics Podcast will be in your feed every weekday to keep you up to date ahead of the 2020 election.
So subscribe wherever you get your podcast, the NPR Politics Podcast, now 5 days a week.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Wiley. He was the research director for Cambridge Analytica, which harvested millions of people's personal data from Facebook and used that and other data to target them with ads, often fake news and conspiracy theories, disinformation, in support of the Trump presidential campaign and the Brexit campaign. Wiley was the research director for Cambridge Analytica, but then became a whistleblower, and he'd testify to all kinds of groups in England and in the U.S. exposing what Cambridge Analytica did. In July of 2014, you were CC'd on a confidential memo that was sent to Steve Bannon, Rebecca Mercer, who's the daughter of Robert Mercer, who bought Cambridge Analytica, and they're both major funders of the right, and Alexander Nix, who was on the board of Cambridge Analytica. And so this memo was from Giuliani's law firm in response to Cambridge Analytica's request for advice on how U.S. law regarding foreign influence on campaigns applied to Cambridge Analytica. And the memo made it clear that the Foreign Agents Registration Act said that foreign nationals are strictly prohibited from managing or influencing an American campaign or PAC, which would mean that Cambridge Analytica, as a British company, really shouldn't have a role in the American campaign. And the memo recommended that Nix recuse himself from management of Cambridge Analytica until a loophole could be explored. And the memo suggested filtering the work of Cambridge Analytica's foreign nationals through American citizens. So to sum up, it sounds like the memo from Giuliani's law firm was saying, well, you can't do this stuff legally, so let's look for some ways to get around the law.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the things that, you know, really concerned me, was that, you know, the American legal counsel, which was Rudy Giuliani's law firm at the time, you know, looked into the legalities of Cambridge Analytica working on, you know, political campaigns that were handpicked by Steve Bannon. And it was pretty clear that, you know, it is not legal in the United States for non-U.S. citizens to exert an influencing or managerial role on an American domestic political campaign. And what I found so concerning is that the legal advice, first of all, said this is probably illegal, but it's okay because we'll try to find some kind of way around it. Loophole is a literal quote. The word loophole was used in that memo. And that I just found it really concerning that even when our own lawyers are saying this is probably not okay, that there's just this total disregard for, you know, any kind of rules. And it's okay, fine, we'll find some Americans and we'll put their names on communications and then it'll be fine. And you know, whether that was, you know, legal or not, I'm not an expert on, you know, American law, but it felt like it was cutting it pretty close. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is that a lot of people who started working at the company who weren't fully aware of what was happening would get sent to the United States not realizing or being told that, like, actually their participation on some of these projects probably was not fully compliant with U.S. law.
What was the last straw that made you quit Cambridge Analytica?
It was a gradual process. It's sort of like boiling a frog in a way that things, you know, change and you don't necessarily notice how much things have changed when you're inside of something. But I think it was, you know, when I get, you know, copied into really suspicious communications, whether it's with, you know, Russian officials or whether it's from our lawyers saying this is unlawful. But really, one of the things that I just remember is seeing videos of people from focus groups and events that Cambridge Analytica was doing who had been targeted and sort of massaged online into believing certain kinds of conspiracies, and just to see, like, the rage in their eyes, that how angry these people were, how they started engaging in highly racialized thinking, and to see people, the actual effects of people, you know, to see their faces and what that looks like, what a manipulated person looks like, for me was really eye-opening. You know, when you sit in London and you work on a computer, you don't necessarily always think about that these records in a database are like actual human beings. And, you know, it was seeing that I think really worried me about what it was doing. And so I left. And very shortly after leaving, you know, they sued me. They tried to pressure me into, you know, signing all kinds of documents that say I'd never work in any kind of political thing again or data thing again. And they made me sign like this sort of extremely strict non-disclosure agreement because they were worried that I would start telling people about what I had seen, which I ended up doing.
What's left of Cambridge Analytica now?
So Cambridge Analytica has dissolved as a corporate entity. It no longer exists. But the people are still working. Several of the people who were working at the company are now working on the next Trump campaign. You know, my concern is that even if Cambridge Analytica has dissolved as a company, its capabilities haven't. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book is to serve as a warning, particularly to Americans, to sort of look at, like, we have a completely unregulated digital landscape. There is almost no oversight. We are placing blind trust in companies like Facebook to do the honorable and decent thing, which is to pay attention to what's happening on their platform. And really, even if Cambridge Analytica doesn't exist anymore, what happens when China becomes the next Cambridge Analytica? What happens when Iran or North Korea or indeed Russia becomes the next Cambridge Analytica? Just because the company has dissolved doesn't mean its capabilities have dissolved. And this really gets to a lot of the responsibility of, you know, companies like Facebook to actually do their job and, you know, respect the democracies and the societies that allow them to be a business and actually, you know, prevent scaled manipulation and disinformation, you know, from existing on their platforms.
Christopher Wiley, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Wiley's new book is called MindF, Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. After we take a short break, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the first solo album by Brittany Howard, the lead singer of Alabama Shakes. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Gelmar, maker of CLR. For some of life's mucky moments, there's CLR. From soap scum to bicycle rust, CLR gets rid of household grime using natural ingredients, not harsh chemicals. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Use it to dissolve calcium, lime, and rust all around your house. Go to clrbrands.com today to learn more about how to keep your piece of the planet muck-free. CLR, making the world a little cleaner.
Support also comes from Teladoc. Have you ever needed a doctor late at night or while traveling? Teladoc offers 24/7 access to board-certified doctors for non-emergency conditions like a sinus infection, allergies, flu, rashes, and more. Teladoc's board-certified doctors can diagnose, treat, and where authorized, prescribe medication to be filled at the pharmacy of your choice. Download the app today or visit teladoc.com/freshair.
Brittany Howard is well known as the lead singer for the Grammy-winning band Alabama Shakes. In the last couple of years, the Shakes have been on a hiatus, and Howard has performed with a couple of other side project bands. But now she's released a solo album. It's called Jamie, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it's a very personal project for her. Here's his review.
Brittany Howard begins her new album, Jamie, with that song called History Repeats. It's a funky, slightly jazzy chunk of music that sounds almost improvised. The song signals to us that this is not going to be the sort of pop soul music that Howard's best-known band, the Alabama Shakes, made. As Howard sings, "I don't want to do it again," she says, "I've already been. I came and went." And she adds, "Don't push me." This album is the sound of Brittany Howard pushing back.
There are miles between us, time between us. There is something between us. I may be a fool to dream of you. But God, it feels so good to dream it all. Something short and sweet. There's always a lot on my head for you. I am waiting. Time's always trying to kill me.
The Jamie of the album title is Howard's sister, who died at age 13 when Brittany was just 8. In her memory, Jamie was a creative girl who is now a spirit that has moved her to make the passionate personal music that fills this album. In a recent interview in the New York Times, Howard said, "For me, this whole record is like, what do I want to listen to? What do I want to hear? That's the whole point. It's not made for anybody else." But in a sense, she's wrong. This isn't selfish music or self-absorbed in any way. It opens outward and draws listeners in. I just want Georgia to notice me. I just want Georgia to notice me. I just want Georgia to notice me. I just want Georgia. Georgia. See, you don't know it, but I'm afraid to tell you how I really feel. I'll show you what I really mean when I say hello. Oh, how I feel to watch you come and go. That's Georgia, a song about a crush Howard had as a kid. Autobiography mixes easily into this album. She writes a song called Goathead about a racist incident that happened to her black father and white mother when Britney was a child. Another song called Stay High is less about ecstasy in a druggy sense than in an emotional high achieved by a meeting of minds and bodies. Brittany Howard's vocal on that piece is high in register. It reminds me of Curtis Mayfield's falsetto. At other points, this album carries echoes of Sly Stone's There's a Riot Going On album, of D'Angelo's album Voodoo, and in Howard's prickliness and willful eccentricity, it reminds me of underrated Joni Mitchell albums like Night Ride Home and Turbulent Indigo. But most of all, it's a Brittany Howard album, something we haven't heard before. The experience of Jamie is like discovering an artist all over again.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Brittany Howard's solo album called Jamie. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about how the same organization that fueled conspiracy theories about the Clintons in 2016 is behind the discredited story involving Joe Biden and his son's work in Ukraine. The organization was founded by Steve Bannon. Our guest will be Joshua Green, a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, who also wrote a book about Steve Bannon and his role in the Trump campaign called Devil's Bargain. I hope you'll join us.
Yeah. This is the check 1-2. The check 3-4. You know who it is. You see, I tried to be everything you ever want, or ever want, you ever would ask me to be, baby. Baby. How could you call me? Babe, you don't provide for me. You don't ride for me. You don't, no, you don't. How could you call me your babe? I tried to do everything you asked me to.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Teresa Madden, Muj Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. I'm Terry Gross. I guess for being so quality, baby.